This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Graceworks Pictures Indivisible, based on the true story of Army Chaplain Darren Turner and his wife Heather. Indivisible, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters October 26th, more information is available at indivisiblemovie.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Thank you so much for joining us again. It is a hymn most of us know, Marvelous Grace of Our Loving Lord, Grace That Exceeds Our Sin and Our Guilt, and the refrain, Grace, Grace, God's Grace, Grace That Is Greater Than All Our Sin. We're probably all singing along as I'm reciting that. We believe this, but do we really understand it? The Bible has so much to say on the topic of grace. For by grace you have been saved through faith, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by His grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. We know those verses, we memorize those verses, but in day-to-day reality, a lot of us wonder, how can God's grace really be greater than all my sin? And that's what we're going to explore today with Kyle Eidelman, who is teaching pastor at Southeast Christian Church in Louisville. And today we'll be talking about his book, Grace Is Greater. And so good to have you here, Kyle. How are you?
Great, Janet. Good to be back with you.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. You know, I like that you say your main objective isn't necessarily to explain grace. We have a lot of books on grace and a lot of people study the subject of grace. Your objective is to help people experience grace. Why? What has gone on in your ministry that has made you see people really need to experience God's grace?
At the church where I am a pastor, I have an opportunity after services on Saturday night and between services on Sunday morning to just sit down and listen to different people tell me their stories. And I've done that now for about 15 years. And after a while, you start to see some patterns. Each story is different, but they have a lot in common. And I tend to find that people might understand grace and that it was explained to them, or that they've memorized some verses, or they can remember going to Vacation Bible School, or as you quoted the hymn earlier, there's some of that can be deeply rooted within people, but just because they know of it doesn't mean they've experienced it. And so my heart as a pastor was increasingly to not just explain it, but to invite people into it. And in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 15, it says, "See to it that no one misses the grace of God." And that idea of missing it is this idea of not experiencing or failing to receive it. And so that's become a prayer for me is, God, I don't want to just be an explainer. I want to help people experience it, because that's what makes all the difference when you're talking about grace.
Right. Well, now, most of these people that you're speaking of, are they already Christians? So these are Christians who are having a difficult time experiencing God's grace after having come to Christ, or some not being Christians?
You know, my experience is one of two things. Number one, people have kind of stayed away from church, or they have stayed away from Jesus because of something that they have done that they're ashamed of, something that has produced a lot of guilt or fear, or they have assumptions that God wouldn't want to have anything to do with them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's because they grew up in the church, or sometimes they didn't grow up in the church, but it's something that they did. The other side of this, what I often see, where something that has been done to them. In other words, they have some hurt or some bitterness or some anger in their life. They are frustrated with God because from their perspective, He let something happen to them that shouldn't have happened to them. And so for both of those groups, grace is the answer. And to learn that, grace is greater than anything that they have done, or grace is greater than anything that's been done to them, is, it's a beautiful thing when somebody discovers that.
Yeah, it sure is. So without getting into all of the details on grace, all of the theological truths about grace, which are all important, but I want to move through what you've talked about in the book as well. When you talk to people about what God's grace really is, how do you explain it as a pastor?
Well, I think one of the best ways to explain it is through story, that grace is something that is caught in narrative. Jesus never actually used the word grace, but we learn a lot about grace in stories, for example, like the prodigal son.
Sure.
So if I'm going to talk to someone about grace, I'll use Romans 5:15 and teach on the fact that while we were still sinners, while we were still far from God, that's when he loved us and he died for us. But I'll also spend some time just telling some stories. And there's something about hearing a story about grace that allows us to connect to it. And so we try to celebrate those stories. We try to lift up those stories that point to the greatness of God's grace.
What about the Samaritan woman? This is one of the passages that you mentioned in the book, John chapter 4, where Jesus is talking to the woman at the well. That's a beautiful story of grace. How do you use that particular story when you're trying to explain to people how God views them?
Well, you know, the Samaritan woman comes and she meets Jesus, and Jesus, you know, offers her the living water, offers himself to her, water that will quench her thirst forever. And she doesn't really follow the metaphor, try to explain it. And so he gets really direct with her, and he invites her to go back and to bring her husband to the well. And she says, you know, I don't have a husband. And Jesus says, well, you're right. You know, you've been married a number of times, and the man you're living with is not your husband. And then she tries to change the subject to some kind of a religious debate, right? And one of the things that I love about grace is that it is personal. It doesn't allow us to turn our attention to just some religious topic or some matter of interpretation, but it gets into our life. It gets a little bit messy when we start talking about experiencing it. Right. And so that's what happens in the story, is that she wants to kind of distract Jesus with a religious debate, and Jesus instead engages her on a more personal level. And I think one of the reasons why this woman was trying to avoid talking to Jesus in a personal way was not just because she was ashamed, but also because she had this assumption that Jesus really wouldn't want to hear that, or wouldn't want to have anything to do with her, that he would be more interested in a religious debate. And it just is this very sweet story of Jesus gently but persistently chasing after her. Yeah. And one of the things I try to talk about within our church is that, you know, a lot of people run from God thinking that he is trying to chase them down and beat them up. But in reality, he's trying to rescue them. And so the persistence of God's grace to meet us where we're at, but not skip over the messiness, but engage us in that.
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite parts of that John 4 passage in that story is where the woman went back to the town after meeting Jesus and said, come see a man who told me everything I ever did. And then, I love that. And then in verse 39, many of the Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did. Now, that kind of fits into the first category you were talking about, people saying, I can't go near Jesus. God doesn't want me. Look at what I've done. Look at all the sins I have. There's no way God would want somebody like me. But this woman did not shrink away from Jesus knowing everything she ever did. She felt accepted when she knew that he knew everything she ever did. That's really powerful to see that in somebody's life that way.
Yeah, and it's sweet that she then is so taken by his acceptance and by his grace that she wants to tell other people about it. The assumption in that story is that she's at the well by herself because she is not traveling with the other women. She's tired of the whispers and the stares and being talked about by the other women. But now she goes back into town and she says, you know, come meet a man who has told me everything I've ever done. And the phrase that I love to use to describe that is that it's a trophy of grace. There's something beautiful about our past when it becomes less about what we did and it becomes more about what God has done for us. And you see that in the church, and if you haven't experienced it, it doesn't make a lot of sense. You see somebody get up and they'll maybe share a testimony or tell a story about something they did from years ago, and you think, well, why would they share that? Why not just kind of keep that in the dark? But they want to tell other people about it because what they have learned is that the greatness of God's grace is, it's better to celebrate that. That's more worth celebrating than what they did is worth being ashamed of. And so I love that idea of just that we're each a trophy of God's grace, where
we are.
Our past shows off God's love and grace and where he meets us.
Absolutely. Kyle Eidelman with us. We're going to come back talking about his book, Grace is Greater. You're listening to Janet Meffer Today. Back in a moment. Over a million refugees are living in tents in Lebanon right now, and most of them are children. They're not eating enough, and they're the targets of Islamic radicalization. They need the Lord, and they need help. But the Christians who run Heart for Lebanon are right there. They need you, though. For a gift of $22, you'll help rescue 4 refugee children and bring them to Heart for Lebanon's Hope Centers, where they can learn, be fed, and come to know Jesus Christ. Please call 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com.
From GraceWorks Pictures comes Indivisible, based on the true story of Army Chaplain Darren Turner and his wife, Heather.
It is with great honor that I have served my country, but I only stand before you today because Jesus is my rock and because I have a family who loves and believes in me.
One marriage, one family, under God. Indivisible, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters October 26th. More information is available at indivisiblemovie.com.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you'll access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 per month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. Regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. That number again, 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. We are back on Janet Meffer Today. My guest, Kyle Eidelman, teaching pastor at Southeast Christian Church in Louisville and author of Grace is Greater, God's Plan to Overcome Your Past, Redeem Your Pain, and Rewrite Your Story. We all need God's grace. And Kyle, we were talking before the break specifically about John chapter 4, the woman at the well, how there are a lot of people you've run into who say, I stay away from church or I stay away from Jesus because I don't think God would want to deal with me. And that flies in the face of the claim that God wouldn't want to deal with you. God knows all about you and is ready to extend his grace to you. But what about the second category of people you've mentioned, people who have had things done to them? Tell me a little bit about those people.
You know, I have, as a pastor over the years, I have been, you know, just amazed at the hurt that has been caused by people, you know, that you hear these stories, you hear enough of them, and you realize how many people are carrying around some pretty deep-seated anger and bitterness, and they've never really talked about it or never really dealt with it. That wound has just scarred over. But in order for there to be healing, that wound has to be opened up. Nobody wants to do that, but it's infected. It needs to be cleaned out. And God's grace has the power to do that. So we oftentimes focus on God's grace being all about what we have done wrong. But there's also the healing of God's grace when it comes to things that have been done wrong towards us.
Yes.
And so the challenge, I think, is to try to help people realize that whatever they have received from God, they now are able to give towards others. And that the beauty of grace is that it always flows. If it's biblical grace, it flows, meaning that what we receive, we are to give. And that even if it feels impossible to forgive, when we spend time focusing on what we've been given, we find that we have it to give. And I've just been humbled by people that have modeled that and set an example of what that looks like, and have been set free from the hurt that was done to them by the grace that God that God gave them.
Yes. Well, it's such a paradox because, as they say, the more you mature as a Christian, the more you realize what a rotten sinner you are. And then the more you know you are loved and forgiven, the more you love God, the more you want to obey him, the more you want to love him back. There's so many things that the way down is the way up is sort of a way to explain it. So for somebody who says, gosh, I really would love to experience God's grace in my life. I'm not a Christian. I left church years ago. I've done some pretty rotten things in my life. Kyle, what do you recommend I do? What do I do to come to Jesus and to experience that grace?
I even love the way you ask the question, because that's how it gets asked, is what do I do?
Yes.
What do I need to accomplish? What do I need to earn in order to pay off this debt, make things right, get in God's good graces, right? And that's so ingrained in us that the way we receive forgiveness or grace is we make things right. I remember as a kid growing up, I was the middle child. I have an older sister and a younger sister. And whenever, you know, there would be conflict or some kind of problem, you know, my parents had taught us, it's a good thing to teach a kid that, you know, you need to make things right. And when you make things right, that your sisters will forgive you, or your sister needs to make things right, and then you forgive them. And so it's just deeply ingrained in us that that's how it works. And so we tend to approach God with that same spirit of what do I need to do to make things right so that I can receive grace and so that I can be forgiven. But biblically, that's not how it works. Biblically speaking, it's something that God has done for us through Jesus, that Jesus paid our debt. As Ephesians says, it is by grace through faith that we have been saved, not by works, so that no one can boast. It's not because we earned it. It's not because we paid off that debt ourselves. It's because of what God has done for us through Jesus. And so that's a difficult mentality for us to accept when we've always been taught the opposite. I was just a few weeks ago was visiting with a man that I'd never met before. I got a phone call just saying that there was a man about my age who didn't have much time left. He was dying of pancreatic cancer. And when I went to visit him, this was his question. I mean, he wanted to know, will I be accepted? And what do I need to do to be accepted when I get to heaven? And, you know, he had had some religious background when he was young, but that was about it. But deeply rooted in his belief system was the fact that there are these scales, and if he hasn't done enough good, then he's not going to get in. And, and so being able to say that's not God's economy, that's not how it works, is a big hurdle for people to get over. It's not based on what we do. It's based on what has been done for us, and it's what we receive through putting our faith in Jesus. But that's a tough one, because we just everything about our system, and as you said, you know, intuitively, it's based upon I got to fix it. I got to make it right.
Yeah, and I think of the Philippian jailer, you know, in Acts 16, what must I do to be saved? And the apostles say, believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved.
That's right.
I mean, that
That's
probably
right.
isn't the answer that a lot of modern day people would expect. They say, okay, well, pay your tithes and go to church every Sunday and don't miss Sunday school, you know, those sorts of things. But really, Christ did it all, or we have no hope. That's what I keep going back to, having been a Christian for the majority of my life, and saying it's all Jesus or there's no hope for me at all. It has to be outside of me, or there's no hope for me going to heaven or any of the rest of us.
Yeah, that's right. And the more we recognize what he's done for us, then the more the rest of it, you know, following after him, or the Bible says that it's his kindness, it's his grace that leads us to repentance, that when we more fully recognize and appreciate what he's done for us, then who we are and what we do flows out of that gift that we've given. So it's not to say that it doesn't matter how you live, or it doesn't matter, you know, the Bible says, should we sin all the more so that grace can increase? And that's not how it works. It's in receiving God's grace and receiving this gift that we have the motivation and we have the desire to follow after him.
That's a critical point. Now, on the issue of us extending grace to other people, that, you know, it's easy to go to the Lord and say, please forgive me for my sins. And sometimes I know it's very hard for me. Somebody will say, I'm sorry. And I'll say, no, I'm holding a grudge. I'm angry at you.
Right.
I'm not over it yet. You're just going to have to give me a little bit of time. But you point out, for example, here's Stephen being stoned, the first martyr in the Christian church. crying out, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. You have Christ on the cross saying, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. And people will look at that and say, how do I get there, Kyle? How do I become that kind of follower of Christ where I'm thinking of my enemy's forgiveness instead of my own hurt? That's a tough one.
It is a tough one. And I would say that it's a journey, that it is not something that you just decide one day that it's forgiven and then you forget about it. It's, you know, it is oftentimes a daily decision to say, I'm going to release this over to God. I'm not going to keep hanging on to it. I'm going to let him handle this. And it doesn't mean that you won't still feel some anger or some bitterness, but it's that you are making a choice to not let that define you, and you're going to release that to God. I know that that for a lot of people, they feel like that the more they rehearse it, the more they relive what's been done to them, the more they're not letting the person get away with it. That's how they think of it.
They do.
But in reality, we're just letting the person continually hurt us and continually cause us pain. And so releasing it and saying, you know, God, I'm giving this to you is a daily prayer. And I think it's a prayer that God honors. One of the things that I challenge folks with is when you're tempted to focus on what's been done to you, replace that with a thought about what's been done for you.
Perfect.
So, you know, my tendency is to focus on the hurt that's been done to me. But if when those thoughts come into my mind, if I can take those thoughts captive and I can replace that with the thought of what's been done for me, what Jesus did for me, then that helps my focus. It helps me release that bitterness and that anger that I'm feeling. So when you're tempted to think about what's been done to you, focus on what's been done for you.
And what I did to Jesus. I mean, when Christ went to the cross, he had never committed one sin in thought, word, or deed, and he was crucified. He was killed in one of the most barbaric ways possible. And he did that so I would not have to pay the price for my own sin for eternity in hell. How in the world can I look at other people and say, I can't extend forgiveness to you? That nobody on earth has done anything even close to what I did to send Jesus to the cross. We need to think like that. I mean, that sounds harsh, but that really is the truth. We are very, very guilty. We have been given great amounts of grace to be forgiven and reconciled to God, considering what we've done to him.
I saw something on Twitter a little while back, and I forget who said it, but the quote was, if the worst sinner you know isn't you, you don't know yourself very well. And when I first read that, I kind of, you know, instinctively pushed back on it. And then I thought, you know, the more I push back on that, the more I kind of reveal that it's true, because, you know, now it's my pride and my self-righteousness that I'm putting confidence in. And yet the older I get, the more I realize how true it is. So that when Paul says, you know, Christ died for sinners, of whom I am the worst, he doesn't say of whom I was the worst. That he understands his own heart. He understands his motives. He understands that just how much God gave for him. And I think when we grow in our faith, we grow in an understanding of how true that is, that we will never be asked to extend more forgiveness to someone else that we have than what we have received from God, and that the litmus test for the reality of the gospel in our lives is that I understand that I understand I'm never going to be asked to forgive more than I've been forgiven.
Oh, that's so well said. Well, Kyle Eidelman, his book is called Grace is Greater, and Kyle, it was so nice to talk to you again. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Jana. It's great to visit with you.
All right. Take care. And we'll be back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Graceworks Pictures Indivisible, based on the true story of Army Chaplain Darren Turner and his wife Heather. Indivisible, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters October 26th, more information is available at indivisiblemovie.com. Welcome back. Well, just a few days ago, the West Virginia Senate passed another bill to repeal the Common Core educational standards. Elsewhere, the standards are slow to be implemented, as in the case of Minnesota schools. But in other states, like Solid Blue California, Common Core is still being touted as a great way to get kids to think critically and is being praised as highly effective. The question for many people, though, now that we have a new administration, is whether or not we can or will do away with Common Core, which is an interesting issue in light of the concerns that many Common Core critics have had about the views of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. So we're going to find out the latest on Common Core and also talk a little bit about its effects on our kids with Joy Pullman. She is managing editor of The Federalist and an education research fellow at the Heartland Institute. Today we'll be discussing her new book, a very important one, The Education Invasion, How Common Core Fights Parents for Control of American Kids. It's so great to have you here, Joy. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know, it's been several years now, as we know, since Common Core was introduced. A lot of parents, though, as you point out in the book, still don't really understand what they're all about. Could you break down for us a little kind of synopsis of what we're discussing when we talk about these educational standards?
Sure. Well, Common Core is basically, I call it an organizing principle for American education because it's basically kind of a control system for determining what and how kids are going to learn, primarily in English and math, but also in all the other subjects from K through 12. So it basically, you know, tells textbook creators and teachers, you know, what they have to be telling, you know, teaching kids in math and English in those grades. And it also basically lays out what the tests are going to measure, you know, whether the kids have learned what the standard creators think is kind of constitutes a good education. So in my book, I use the metaphor from Lord of the Rings, you know, one ring to bind them all and in the darkness, you know, hide them. That's kind of what Common Core is. Everything can connect to it, and it was designed to be that way.
Yes. Now, there have been a lot of arguments against Common Core that we've heard over the last several years as people have been debating it and trying to get rid of it and all the rest. What would you say are the strongest arguments against it?
Well, I think that I'm going to give you a number and then I'm going to expand them, right? Usually I give about four or five that are the main ones that I hear from people. The number one that matters to me, you know, and people's priorities differ, is the quality of it.
Right.
So simply put, we know that you can do better for kids than Common Core, you know, and that's been objectively proven with evidence and examples from other states such as Indiana, Massachusetts, and even California are well known. And portions of Texas's standards, depending on what year, you know, they come from, are also pretty well regarded. So Common Core has been even measured up, you know, by its proponents as not as good as those other, you know, the best in the nation standards. So objectively, you know, why would you ever give kids anything worse than you know, the alternatives available?
Right.
Second of all, of course, there's the issue of taking more and more control away from teachers and parents, the people who are in front of individual children, and giving more of it to unelected bureaucrats, you know, that aren't accountable to the American people. And so that's a huge part of Common Core. Of course, it's not Common Core's fault that this is kind of the situation that we have in American education, but it is its fault that it's getting worse. Another aspect of that is, you know, kind of increasing the importance of the test. It was linked with a number of Obama administration mandates that made, you know, a test more important in judging schools and kids and teacher pay and kind of telling states how they need to run their education systems. And with the testing is kind of point four, there's actually a big expansion of very minute personal information that Common Core is designed to harvest about kids' learning and even something about their social backgrounds and their ideas and so forth. And so, I mean, there's a lot of different reasons, you know, that people are against Common Core, but those are kind of some of the main ones that matter to me.
Right. Well, when I look at the subtitle on your book talking about how Common Core fights parents for control of American kids, that for a lot of parents is the number one thing they really object to, is feeling as if the federal government is taking over education in a way that historically was always left to the local community. What do you think the objective, when you look at all these unelected bureaucrats who were behind formulating the standards and the implementation with the race to the top and all that back in 2010, what is the objective, would you say, when it gets right down to it, of those who imposed it? Is it really about making education better, or is there just more to it?
Well, I think I am willing to give good faith, you know, to my opponents. I don't think most of them intended evil for American
right.
kids. They genuinely think, you know, that this program is going to be good for the country and for kids. So I think the real question you have to say is, well, how do we know, you know, whether my idea of what's good for kids or your idea is going to be the actual one that works? And so, of course, basically their method of pushing their ideas on Americans didn't allow us to have the American right to self-government. We weren't allowed to have a say in whether we wanted this to be taught to our kids. And a Common Core kind of represents and, again, exacerbates that growing trend of a lack of a voice, of a lack of control, of a lack of a consent to the government, you know, that rules our lives in minute details, such as the kind, you know, the kind of second grade math problems my kid is learning. Right. You know, if I can't have an influence on that, or even if I have to go through, you know, years and years of fighting with my teacher, my principal, my local school district, you know, just because my kid is crying over math homework at night, you know, something's wrong with our education system and with our political system when that's, you know, that's happening. Yeah. So I think, as you mentioned, the subtitle of my book, I kind of think Common Core really lays bare that when we talk about education politics or just politics in general, there's really only two ways of running it. You can either do it from the top down or you can do it from the bottom up. And Common Core represents the top-down style of decision-making that's been popular in Europe and in Asian societies. And, I mean, I think Americans have historically liked better and they've been promised our birthright, our right to self-government, to, you know, have consent of the governed. And so we should, you know, I think we need our governor, our government to give us more of that power back to us to be able to say, no, I want my kid to learn according to this method of teaching. I should be free to make that choice.
Absolutely. What about some of these charges about the questionable content at times of the Common Core or the age inappropriateness of some of what the kids are learning?
Right. So Common Core has an appendix of kind of recommended books, and there's some really great things on there, like one item on the Bill of Rights, I think it's the First Amendment, as well as the Constitution and Declaration of Independence. But among them include a couple of, honestly, I mean, I'm a grown married woman, you know, I've you know, gotten past, you know, childishness about, and so I'm not a prude, but these books I wouldn't want to read myself, and let alone give to my kids. So there's a couple titles on there that are just straight up raunchy. You know, they describe rape, they describe incest, you know, so on and so forth, and they are recommended as good texts to be teaching high school students. Well, again, that's I know in Texas that's been controversial, but it's been in a lot of other states, you know, that people have, you know, for good reason, parents have opposed that.
Right, exactly. Well, and what about the opting out? Because one of the things I was reading recently is that educational leaders who have seen this, you know, lots and lots of student test refusals skyrocket over the past several years don't expect this year to be any different. How many are opting out? Where does that stand right now, Joy?
Well, it depends on the state. It just really depends on how, you know, well organized and informed parents are locally. And so, for example, in recent years, you know, the states like New York have had really high opt-out rates. And in some school districts, it's been up to, you know, 70-80%. But more commonly, we've just been basically seeing a spike, of, you know, nationwide that kind of crest. There's a federal requirement that 95% of kids that are eligible take the test that the feds mandate. And so in a number of states, that number has been iffy. So the overall, it's been just kind of broaching that 5% or more mark, depending on the state. And so the reason that parents have do that, it does relate to Common Core, but it also, again, relates to, I think parents are expressing their frustration over the fact that they have so little control over what their kids are learning. So they, you know, parents often don't have another option that is better than their neighborhood school, that public school that's required, you know, to follow all these mandates from all these different levels. So I see the test as kind of an expression of choice, of voice, you know, for parents to be saying, look, I don't have a better school available to my kid that isn't teaching Common Core or bad curriculum, but I can say I can mitigate the effects of this curriculum on my kid. He's not going to take this test. It's a waste of his time. Please give him a book and put him in the library.
And preferably not one of those raunchy ones on the Common Core list. Yeah, you can understand
it. I mean, anyway, depending on the test, I would think, you know, my kid might be better served reading comics.
Yeah, for sure. Bring out Archie. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Well, we're going to come back. Joy Pullman with us talking about the education invasion, how Common Core fights parents for control of American kids. We'll return on Janet Mefford Today right after this. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. Did you know that this fall you can help create the next great Christian missionary force? It's true. Right now in Lebanon, there are 2 million refugees who are living in tent settlements, and they're really the innocent victims of the brutal Syrian civil war. Did you know more than half of them are children who are at great risk of Islamic radicalization and sex trafficking? Many of them have only their mothers. But in the midst of the darkness, Heart for Lebanon is offering the hope of the gospel. They have wonderful hope centers there in Lebanon, and there they feed these children. They give them a Christian education. And most importantly, they introduce them to our Savior for the very first time. The stories are incredible, and hearts are really open right now as the Lord changes their lives and brings them to a saving knowledge of the Lord Jesus Christ. But right now, we need your help. Your gift of $22 will rescue four children who come to these hope centers and find a Christian education and get fed, which is what they need. They need basic care. They need basic education. And most of all, they need the gospel. Now, if you can give a gift of $98, you'll be rescuing 18 children. This is an entire classroom full of kids. Will you please help us help these children? They will go home one day, and then they'll be able to reach their nations for Christ. What an opportunity the Lord is giving to us right now. If you can call and help, here's the number. 866-485-9187. That's 866-485-9187. Once again, 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Please pray and please give whatever you can while the Lord works in the lives of these children. What a great opportunity to create the next great Christian missionary force. The number to call again, 866-485-9187, 866-485-9187. Thank you so much for whatever you can do. We are back on Janet Mefford. Today, my guest is Joy Pullman, managing editor of The Federalist and an education research fellow at the Heartland Institute, author of The Education Invasion, How Common Core Fights Parents for Control of American Kids. Now, a lot of people, Joy, are looking at the new administration coming in as being maybe a good sign that things can change. We have a new education secretary, Betsy DeVos. But I'm sure you know she gave this interview not too long ago where she said the notion of a common core, it's basically already been disposed of by this Every Student Succeeds Act. Do you agree with that?
Right.
Is that true?
No.
Yeah, I thought not. Why? Why is that? Yeah.
Well, it depends on kind of who you're willing to believe. It depends on whether people who support Common Core, and you know, I've talked to folks in our home state of Michigan, and they say that in local politics, you know, Betsy DeVos and her family were staunch supporters of Common Core in their state. So that doesn't necessarily mean that she's going to push it at the federal level. She could, you know, think that's appropriate at the state level and not the federal. That's her prerogative. But Common Core is embedded far more deeply, you know, in a number of education systems, such as the federally funded test, such as the criteria that federal bureaucrats use to determine, to tell states basically what they're allowed to teach children and how they have to do it and how they have to train teachers. There's just a great web of unseen mandates, you know, unseen to the public mandates that give the federal government a vast amount of control over what school systems look like and how kids learn and how they're educated. And Common Core is deeply enmeshed in that web. So, I mean, Common Core, it represents a style of educating that is very progressive. It assumes, you know, that the goal of citizenship is basically to be, you know, workers in an economy as opposed to self-governing citizens who have a right, you know, to self-determination, to have a full life, you know, that isn't only defined by how much money they make or their name on their business card. So, again, the Common Core is kind of a competing vision of education that many Americans don't share, and it is embedded throughout the federal the way the federal government tends to run education, and now that Betsy DeVos is in charge of. So we hear from our Republican leaders such as her, you know, that I also heard that recently from John Klein. He's the House Chair of the Education Committee in the U.S. House.
Yeah.
Hey, we don't have to worry about Common Core at the federal level. We took care of that. We eliminated the mandate in the Every Student Succeeds Act. But the short answer is that is really false, because the criteria that same bill uses to judge state standards and tests is Common Core defined criteria. So they basically took the words Common Core out, but they used the definition of Common Core and they're applying it to states still.
Wow. So now when we have President Trump saying that he wants to stop Common Core, and there also is a bill out there wanting to just eliminate the Department of Education, which probably is a long shot. How would you recommend that Common Core be dealt with? What should be happening in the Department of Education insofar as it continues to exist in order to deal with the concerns that parents have on a local level about their public schools?
That's a really great question. And I actually have written about that in detail because I think there's a lot that the Education Secretary and the Trump administration can do. Because I think it's important to think about President Trump is someone who my colleague at the Federalist, Molly Hemingway, has said he's not a hyper-literal fellow. When he speaks and says, I'm going to get rid of Common Core, we're going to get rid of Obamacare, he basically is saying to Americans, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I understand your frustration with the system that Common Core embodies.
Right.
And, you know, I'm going to use my powers to take care of your frustration with that system. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of pressure points at the federal level that his administration can do that. So let me give some example. So I just talked about the federal government using Common Core style criteria to judge what states are allowed to have in their tests and their curriculum mandates. Well, they could stop judging states according to Common Core criteria. You know, that's an easy one. The federal government funds a lot of teacher training programs, you know, or teacher certification programs. They tell teacher training schools, you know, what they consider a good style of teacher education. Well, they should stop, you know, telling them to use Common Core criteria, right? They should stop funding programs that teach, you know, that indoctrinate teachers in the Common Core methodology. So on and so forth. You know, so there's just a lot of things that Secretary DeVos and the Trump administration can do to make good on that power. But to be honest, the chief thing that really will seal the deal on President Trump's promise is to go to Congress and to drastically reduce the power that the federal government has over education and let states and localities and parents, you know, return to being the ones who determine what education looks like for their individual kids.
Right. I think all of that is very common sense. But of course, as we know, at the federal level, once something becomes embedded, it can be very difficult to get rid of because you have all the teachers unions and the, you know, the special interests and the progressive activists. Oh, you're going to fail the children. You're going to fail the children. Do you see Common Core at any point being disposed of? That, I mean, is there enough political will, do you think, among the people? Or do you think it's just going to have to continue to go along its merry way until enough people get frustrated that would happen? In other words, are we at a point where we really could get rid of it if people would just push for that?
Well, here's the thing about education policy, especially at the federal level, particularly at the federal level. There will be a large, what they call grass tops, astroturf, you know, like you said, unions will cry, you know, that the end of the world's Armageddon if the, you know, president and Republicans in Congress talk about reducing the federal role in education. But the truth is that voters, especially President Trump and the Republican base, you know, those voters are not voting based on the education issue primarily. So basically, Trump and Republicans could do whatever they wanted in it, and they could totally get away with it. The only question, you know, is whether that's what they choose to spend their time on. They have a really historic opportunity with having control over all three branches of the federal government right now. And, I mean, I'm going to be honest, I don't have a lot of faith in Republicans. They're, you know, the ones who have bungled this time and time again at the state level.
Yep.
But they, honestly, they really do have the opportunity to do something big here, and I do not think it would hurt them electorally if they chose to do so.
What about the issue, because this argument is always being brought up, what about the failing schools? You know, fine, you live in a nice affluent area, you have high taxes, you have good schools, it's not fair for the kids who live in areas that don't have good schools. Betsy DeVos has talked about the need for vouchers and school choice and that sort of thing. But what is the argument to be made against federalizing education in the way Common Core has when they bring up the failing schools argument?
Oh, that's another really great question. I can answer from having talked with teachers who work in some of those really struggling, typically, you know, inner city, but sometimes also the rural schools. You know, and basically she said to me that Common Core, in her school, the way that it has looked is taking kids who can barely read, you know, even though they're eighth graders, they're ninth graders, and putting them in quote-unquote college prep classes, you know, and she's forbidden from failing them out of that class. So basically the kids are shoved ever towards graduation when they really have, you know, the actual skills of a second or a third grader. Mm. That's not helping kids. You know,
no.
That system isn't set up to meet the children where they are and actually, you know, get them moving ahead. And that is something as a teacher she wants to be doing with her time. You know, she's not cold-hearted. She's not jaded. You know, she is there for her students. But the rules that are in place are prohibiting her from actually meeting her students where they are and uplifting them, you know, to the best that they can do, you know, under her care. So Common Core, again, this is the problem when you have, when you set, you know, one kind of bar for every single person, it's not going to fit everybody's situation.
Right.
You know, some eighth graders are ready for college level math. Some eighth graders are barely ready for second grade math, you know?
Yeah.
So, the, you know, a one size fits all, as we, you know, all know, it's a cliche, but it's true. Common Core is not a good fit for every single school. And then if you just take that one specific thing and multiply it by the thousands of differences between human beings, you know, then, you know, you just see how ridiculous it is to think that, you know, one system could possibly be a good fit for every American child.
Exactly. So what would your advice be to parents who are maybe having kids in public schools and are frustrated by Common Core? What are some things teachers and parents especially can do to maintain control over their kids and their education?
Well, that's a really great question, because I do think if you repeal, you know, federal mandates, even if you repeal Common Core, that's a start. But, it, you know, it isn't going to really get us towards a good education ecosystem, because then people have to use the freedom that they have responsibly. And our failures in using our local control responsibly have pushed us towards more central control, even though that's not a good answer, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think parents do need to push for more, local control is good, but I actually think local control is no good for a parent if that school isn't working for that specific child, you know,
right.
No matter what they're doing.
Right.
You know, so a federal monopoly is terrible, but a district monopoly, you know, isn't any good either. A parent, you know, they're not going to go through school board meetings for 3 years just to get their child out of one math class. It's far better if they can just say, all right, well, I tried to resolve this with my teacher and principal. It wasn't successful. We're going to a new school this year. So all of that to say, you know, I'm a big supporter of school choice programs that are real school choice, not where you use the choice to tell private schools, you know, that they have to turn into the public schools parents are leaving, you know, to go to them,
right.
But where you really do allow parents to take their own kids, their own education money, and have a real option, a different kind of curriculum, a better family fit.
I think that's
And the
smart.
Second one, yeah, and so that's a political option. If for parents and teachers who are looking for better ways to benefit their kids, I recommend they look up these books. You can get at basically every public library. It's called the What My First Grader, Kindergartner, Third Grader Should Know series. I believe it goes through at least sixth grade. It might go through eighth.
I love it.
Gives
Joy,
a book list.
Yep, awesome. I got to run, but Joy Pullman, The Education Invasion, thank you so much, Joy, and thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
This hour of Janet Meffer Today was brought to you by Graceworks Pictures Indivisible, rated PG-13 in theaters October 26th. More information at indivisiblemovie.com.